Hello and welcome to You Really Shouldn't Have, with me, James Warwick, the podcast where each week I sit down with a different guest as we discuss their career and unwrap the story on the worst gift they've ever been given. Now joining me on this week's show is George Kalajahan. He stopped by to tell me all about the art of pleating and his career in fashion and textiles, along with, of course, the story of the worst gift he's ever been given. So, George, welcome to the show. It's so great to have you here.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Now, I didn't know an awful lot about pleating before I was contacted about you coming on the show, and I thought I'd better do some research to find out exactly what we're going to be talking about. But pleating is an art form that dates back thousands of years. How did you and your family first get involved in the pleating business?
My family has been involved in the textile industry for over five generations. So far, I've been able to trace it back between 125, 150 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's quite a long time. And specifically pleating, what happened is this. So my great-great-grandfather had a textile mill, and he used to do something called jacquard. And jacquard is a type of fabric weaving where you actually weave a design in the fabric. And his son went to study in Lyon, France. And Lyon, France, back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, was the textile capital of the world. Actually, for about 400 years, you know, France, Lyon, France was like the textile capital. And he learned everything there about jacquard card punching, which is what it's called. And he happened to see some people doing something in France, some pleating over there. And when he went back to the Middle East in Damascus, where my family was at that time, he taught his nephews how to do the jacquard weaving, but he went to his niece and he said, "Hey, listen, I saw this thing in France, you know, this is what they did. It's something like this." And my grandmother, being an incredibly industrious woman, basically figured it out, started developing her own techniques, became so good at it that she became incredibly profitable, very lucrative for her at the time because it was all top secret. Nobody knew how to do it. And that's how she started. And it became so lucrative that basically the entire, my family stopped textiles. They abandoned the textile business and they converted all the operations to pleating.
Because I understand you moved over to New York at a young age, didn't you? You were born in Lebanon, is that right?
Yes, I was born in Lebanon and I moved to New York when I was, I think, 5 years old or something like that.
And I understand that, you know, following in the family business wasn't always something you envisioned. I know you went off and tried a number of careers before coming back and working with your father.
Yes, I actually couldn't stand pleating when I was a kid. I made every attempt to escape. I did many different careers in my life. I joined a computer consulting company because I had a passion for computer graphics. I became a teacher for a while. I was teaching technology. And then I happened to work in a bar. And then I happened to buy a bar. And then I happened to be in a hip hop band.
Oh, wow.
I mean, yeah. It just, I kind of did a whole bunch of stuff. And then one day it kind of hit me like a ton of bricks. I came back to New York to visit my family. I was living in Florida for several years and I came back and then I kind of saw my father and it just was such a like emotional impression for me to see what he had done, what he had done his entire life, what everyone before him had done, how he was carrying the torch, and that if nobody carried the torch after him, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years of knowledge and expertise would be gone. So I decided to step back in and carry the torch, and now here I am.
I'm not going to ask you for any professional secrets or anything, but I wondered if you could talk me through the general process for pleating fabric.
Sure. So pleating can be done in three ways.
Okay.
One is it can be folded by hand and then just pressed with an iron, which is usually what most at-home seamstresses do. So that's not something that we necessarily focus on. The second way is through the use of a machine. Okay, there are a few different types of machines that are built, and these machines will fold the fabric, and they will usually roll the fabric, and then you would put it in like an oven and cook it. So that's one way with these large industrial machines. That's the second way. And the third way is with the use of a mold. And the molds look like they're made of cardboard, and they're folded in a various array of styles. There's just your basic styles, which are lines up and down, and then there are some crazier types of origami-like patterns. But the fabric is placed inside of this mold, and the mold is compressed and bind, and then it's put in a giant steam box, a highly pressurized steam box, and the fabric is cooked and cooled, and it will retain the impression of whatever the mold is.
And on average, how many garments or how many rolls of fabric are we talking about in terms of pleating in, say, a month or a year for you guys?
It so varies based on the type of work we have. Now, I'm going to answer that question based on pre-corona.
Uh-huh.
pre-corona, I would say we would probably pleat about 1,000 to 2,000 yards, meters per month, maybe.
Wow.
Something of that nature. You know, but it really totally depends. I mean, sometimes we have clients that are less, their product is less expensive, and maybe they'll give us like 5,000-6,000 yards. And then we have some clients that, you know, one garment can be $25,000. And so that would require less pleating, but the time consumed is considerably more. So we get a wide array of types of work. You know, I mean, most of our clients are mid-range to couture.
You mentioned Corona there, which brought me on nicely. I wanted to touch on the cheeky mask. I know that was something you worked on during the lockdown.
Yes, yes. So I didn't really have any intention of making masks when Corona first came about, because, you know, it just seemed like everyone was making it. You know, my factory was actually shut down. I wasn't able to go inside. And I felt like at any minute now, Corona was going to be over. So it just seemed like, you know, it wasn't the right, you know, it just seemed like everyone else is doing it and other people can do more mass production, and we're not really able to make anything that's really inexpensive. I don't know if that's the right way of phrasing that,
yeah.
But you know, we are a higher end shop. So, you know, I knew it was going to cost us a lot of money. And so my wife was complaining about those god awful masks that she had to put on, the surgical masks. And my wife had a very petite face, and she would complain so much and tell me how she felt like she was putting a diaper on her face. and so I thought, okay, let me make my wife some masks. And she complained primarily about her cheekbones. She's like, these cover my cheekbones. You know, I want people to see my cheekbones. It's not, you know, I don't like this. So I made something for her, and I sculpted it to fit her face perfectly and to accentuate her cheekbones. And she went on Facebook and just posted some pictures on Facebook, and then her Facebook exploded. And everyone was like, I want one, I want one, I want one. And then we're like, okay, fine, like, let's do this. And then that's how the cheeky mask was born.
Fantastic. You've worked on a number of huge projects in your career and with some of the world's biggest names in fashion. What projects during your career really stand out for you as highlights?
There are some that are not necessarily, say, sexy, say it that way, that were very technically challenging. And that one was a project where somebody wanted us to make 14-foot-long pleats that were almost 1/8 of an inch big.
Wow.
And it was an incredibly difficult project. And we had almost no time to make it. And there were a lot of physical challenges in doing it. And we finally figured it out. And it was one of those things where, you know, the mother of, what do they say? Necessity is the mother of invention. That's what they say. Necessity is the mother of invention. So I tried everything possible until we finally cracked the code. It was me and my father. We were working on it. I still work with my father basically very closely every single day. And we finally got the project done. And, you know, I grew a tremendous amount during that project. You know, another project, which I would say was also very, 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 very intense. And again, very intense deadline. Major customer was the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And they wanted us to replicate a gown, which was made by this famous designer from the 1900s called Mariano Fortuny. I was a little bit very sure of myself when I was speaking to them. And I was like, yeah, no problem. I can do it. And they're like, oh, this can't be replicatable. I'm like, don't worry about it. I'm going to do something that's going to blow your mind. And it was quite a difficult challenge because to find the right fabric to mimic what was done in the 1900s by some other guy who lived in a different climate, who use different techniques and different tools, and you have to figure it out, was very, very challenging. And we worked on it for about 3 months, and I almost went into like a depression because we almost didn't figure it out. And then my father comes to work one morning and he says, son, he's like, I think I figured something out. Let's give it a try. And I was like, okay, Dad, okay, let's try. and we did, and it was it. It was like completely my mood changed, you know, 360 degrees, and we figured it out. It looked beautiful. We made the gowns for them, and it was so beautiful that, you know, my gowns were in the Metropolitan Museum, basically next to the original designers, and people were walking by and taking, you know, admiring them. They weren't taking pictures of them, but I was taking pictures, no one could tell that it wasn't the original design. So, I mean, I felt like that was a particularly proud moment that, you know, no one had the ability to actually notice the difference. Like if you scrutinize, I asked my wife, I'm like, can you see a difference? Can you see which one is mine and which one is not? And she couldn't tell. So,
wow. That's incredible. Incredible.
Yeah, it was a very proud moment. And again, like I said, you know, when you have to do something and you have no choice and you can't back out, I mean, the things that you end up coming with and the growth that you experience in your craft is, you know, it's incredible. It's incredible. I've grown a lot by putting myself in those situations. They're not always comfortable. They usually are very uncomfortable. But I think it's the uncomfort that actually makes you grow.
Now, fashion itself, George, is something that is forever changing in terms of, you know, styles and looks. I wondered if your process in terms of pleating has to change at all to keep up with those, say, new ideas.
So, yeah, there are some variations in the process. But in essence, the process somewhat stays the same. It's just what you do during the process to create a different look, and the look, which is what is needed and wanted for that particular season. So like this season, for example, everyone is asking me for more of a crushed and distressed look. So in essence, what I do is I apply heat, pressure, and steam to fabric to manipulate it. Uh-huh. And with those three basic variables, there are thousands of permutations that can be created.
I wanted to touch on the book as well, Pleating, Fundamentals for Fashion Design, which you wrote with your father. How did you find that process of putting the book together?
That process was quite another challenge. So one of the main reasons why I wanted to write the book was because I felt that it would force me to confront my father's vast knowledge and to extract all of the data that he has in his brain. You know, ever since I was a child, I was enamored by how much my father knew, his expertise on the subject of the garment industry. And so I thought that in the beginning that, you know, when I was going to write the book, I thought, I remember getting the pen and paper, and it was a Saturday, and I said, okay, Dad, we're going to start on the book. Come, okay. And I sat down at the table and I was like, okay, Dad, so what should I write about? Where should I start? And he says to me, ask me a question. And I said, I just did. Where should I start? And he goes, I don't know what to tell you. Give me a more specific answer. I'm like, well, I don't know what to ask you. And he's like, well, then I don't know what to tell you. So it was a very frustrating time to actually to write the book. It took me actually from start to finish. It was a 4-year process, but it took me 3 years to write it. The first 2 years, it was me floundering around. The last year, I really made a lot of headway. And then 1 year of editing back and forth with the publisher. And then 4 years later, we had the finished product. And I'll tell you, the whole process was, it was almost felt like a roller coaster ride, because 1 minute I'm like thinking, yeah, I'm going to write this book. It's going to be great. You know, everyone is going to love it. Everyone's going to learn so much about it. And they're going to see how much my family has created and developed this art form. And then there were times when I was like, my God, who am I kidding? I can't write a book. Where did I get off thinking I was an author?
And did you learn more throughout the writing process? Were there things about pleasing that you didn't know everything about that you say learned even more knowledge than you already had?
Oh, 1,000,000%.
Yeah.
It was a complete transformation process for me. And like I said earlier, you know, I threw myself in a situation where I couldn't wiggle out of it. So I signed the deal. I signed a contract with the publisher before I even had written the book. And he followed up with me every year. I'm like, yeah, I'm working on it. It's almost done. But it put me in that situation where, you know, you have to deliver.
Yeah.
And, you know, you know, there's just something about that necessity that when it kicks in, you can manage to do anything. Oh my
God! George, we reached the part of the show where I have to ask you, what is the worst gift you've ever been given?
So I've thought about this quite a bit. But when I got this gift, I want to set this up by saying I was a teenage boy. I was about 13 years old.
Okay.
And, you know, the gift that I received was a notebook. And I remember opening it up and being like, what am I going to do with a notebook? And I tried to hide my emotions, but the person was there and they're like, oh, isn't that great? I love that thing. You know, you can write down your thoughts in it. And I'm thinking to myself, my thoughts, what is this guy talking about? So that was my experience. But I will say, when I was thinking about this, I was actually very curious by this question, because it's a very interesting question. And I started asking everyone that I know also, what is their worst gift? And I asked my assistant, and she told me that her worst gift was a jigsaw puzzle that she got. And she started putting it together. And at the end of the jigsaw puzzle, she realized that there were 5 pieces missing.
That's so brilliant.
How frustrating is that?
Especially if it was like a 10,000 piece jigsaw as well. Like you go through all that effort of putting it together and you never get to see the finished picture.
Exactly.
George, a couple of questions from me to wrap up. If you could go back to your childhood and rescue a gift you had as a kid that you don't have now, what would you go back and rescue?
I would love to have my Colnago track bike.
Nice.
I had a beautiful Italian fixed track bike that I saved years to build. And the final, basically my brother gifted me, you know, the money to finish it. And I had it for several years. And then it was one of those times in my life where it was like, okay, do I want the money or do I want the thing? Do I have to pay bills and this and that? And I ended up selling it, and I dearly regret that.
And if you could go back to the beginning of your career and give yourself a gift to help to get where you are now, what gift would you give yourself?
My gift would be to give myself a time machine so I can ask myself what mistakes did I do and where did I waste my time?
I like that. George, where can people find out more about you and what you do?
They can go to my Instagram, which is at International Pleading. They can go to my website, which is internationalpleading.com. And also there was a documentary shot about us by Scientology TV. And that link is also on our website under our press page. And our press page does have a lot of other press related things like this. Like, you'll eventually be there as well, James.
On it, absolutely on it. The documentary is great. I should have said, I took a look at that before speaking with you. It's a fantastic watch, so do make sure you check the documentary out. George, it's been great to have you here. Thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you so much, James.
Thanks again for listening to this episode of You Really Shouldn't Have. Be sure to subscribe to us on your chosen podcast service to make sure you never miss another episode. You can find us on both Twitter and Instagram at Bad Gifts Pod, as well as online at badgiftspod.com.